Welcome back to the Mojo Podcast with me, Richard Stokes. Whether this is your first time or you're a regular listener, it's great to have you here and I'm thankful you've chosen to spend a bit of your lockdown life with me and my guest. This week we're talking about dating and here's something that helps me set this up.
Not so good. He walked me to the subway and said, we should do this again.
Oh.
What?
He said we should do it again. That's good, right?
No. Loosely translated, we should do this again means you will never see me naked. Oh.
Since when?
Since always. It's like dating language, you know, like, it's not you means it is you.
Or you're such a nice guy means I'm going to be dating leather-wearing alcoholics and complaining about them to you.
Or you know, I think we should see other people means. I already am.
And everybody knows this.
Oh, yeah. Cushions the blow.
Yes, dating, whether from the early 90s or now, has its own rules, language, behaviours, which have to be understood to be successful. And my guest this week has literally written the book on it. Ben Arugundade is the author of My Terrifying, Shocking, Humiliating, Amazing Adventures in Online Dating, in which he chronicles his own dating experiences as a man in his early 50s thrust into the app-dominated world of dating. During his time dating, he worked out how to make the system work for you rather than against you, and he shares his painful and hilarious anecdotes in his book, as well as a bunch of recipes for success. So we talk about his reflections, tips and advice on online dating, but of course we kick off talking about the world we're in right now, a world under lockdown. We talk about how Ben fuels his mojo, how he gets into flow as a creative, and the impact of COVID-19 on relationships right now. Ben was a great guest, and given he's a true multi-hyphenate, he's a writer, publisher, entrepreneur, and as you'll hear, he's a voice artist. We could have talked for days on many topics, but I'm respectful of your time, so we kept it to well under an hour. I hope you enjoy. Hello, and welcome back to the Mojo Podcast in lockdown. It's the second show recorded under these circumstances, but Wi-Fi seems to be holding up, and my guests are being extremely resilient and very accommodating with the new circumstances. You know, I think we're all kind of adapting and embracing change right now, which will probably be good for us in the long run. I've been looking forward to talking to today's guest for a while, since we were introduced by a great mutual friend of ours, who thoughtfully enough connected us and we had a chat on the phone. So here we are. Hello, Ben, and how are you?
Hello, Richard. I'm very well, thank you.
And Ben, I always start out this way. How is your mojo today?
Very good. Considering the circumstances, I'm keeping all of the health and psychological things up to speed during this period, which I think is the most important thing, is to not let incarceration, if you want to call it that, interrupt your flow of what you usually will try and do to keep yourself fit and strong.
I was having a really good conversation with my wife yesterday about that exact subject of flow and how we can try and get into flow in these circumstances. What are you doing to find flow right now?
What's interesting for me is when you restrict anything and you then have to focus on the fewer opportunities that you do have. So obviously Boris Johnson has said to us, we're only allowed to go out for maybe 2, maximum 3 times a day. And that's an interesting restriction. So you think, okay, so what can I do with that? I'm allowed to go to the shops. Which shop should I go to? Because one that's slightly further away means there's more of a walk, which is good for me. Or if we're allowed to go out for exercise, we should take that opportunity to go out then every day and run as I do. Instead of my usual circuit of maybe 3 or 4 times a week, I now run every day because it's an opportunity to be outside. So it's also about making the best use of the restrictions and putting a new energized routine into that.
Got it. So I think we're learning new ways, right? In this time of restriction, we're finding ways to almost to hack the scenario we're in.
Yeah, I mean, new things always come out of these sorts of situations. Hopefully, I think my belief is this is partly why these things happen. They're supposed to teach us things. I remember in this country, we had the tube strike a few years ago, and that went on for some weeks, and people started walking to work and buying bicycles and cycling to work. And then when the tube strike ended, people carried on. And so these things always present an opportunity for change things that we're doing. Are we going to now have a different attitude to fitness? Are we going to now appreciate the freedom to go outside and be in nature, for example? So hopefully when this is over, we will all be changed positively in some way.
Yeah, amen to that. And I guess it depends how long it goes on for, and I suppose how profound, I mean, it seems pretty profound already, how profound the changes we experience are, I suppose, to how our habits and our routines are shifted by the experience we're going through. So you talked about flow there when thinking about mojo. Is that how would you define mojo for yourself?
For me, it I think it refers back to the ancient principles, the East Asian principle of qi, or the Sanskrit word prana, which referred to the life force energy of all living things. So for me, mojo is energy. What is the level of my energy today in order to achieve the things I want? Because that is the fuel for everything that we do. So my definition of it is about how much, what is the power of the furnace within your body today? To what extent, how intensely is it burning this morning or this afternoon or this evening?
Oh, I love that metaphor, the internal furnace.
Yeah, because that's the fuel to do anything you want to do. You know, if whatever you want to do in life, it can't be accomplished unless you have the fuel, you know, unless you're putting the logs of wood into the engine, you know.
Building on that fantastic metaphor of yours in terms of the fuel that's going in, what is that for you? Is that, you know, you talked about getting out and running sounds very important for you. What else is it that is your fuel?
I mean, it starts, the foundation for me is to use the word fuel, is what you put into the engine. And so the best way for me to have the foundation for my mojo is to eat properly, take the vitamins, drink water, avoid processed foods and the things that are going to detract from the energy. So it's, for me, it starts there. And particularly now, you know, when we're in the throes of an epidemic, you think, well, how can I keep my immune system the strongest it can be? Well, you know, take the vitamin D, eat fresh vegetables, et cetera, et cetera. It's the kind of basics for living that we should all be focusing on even more intensely. So that's the basis of the mojo for me, is what fuel are you putting into your engine, into your car? And then obviously after that, it's about how you then move and exercise that car, that engine. And so my second practice is to be out running every day through Hyde Park, which is close to where I live. And that's partly about being outside and also about being connected to nature and running with trees as opposed to past them, if you like. And all of the restorative energetic elements of nature, therefore, then are with you and part of the energizing force. So you're kind of, certainly when I do it, I'm hyper aware of what is around me. So one of the most beautiful sensations of running is feeling the wind caress its way around your face and then away continuously. Or to look at the incredible creativity that is apparent in every single tree. Why do the branches grow at these weird angles that they do? We can't really explain it. But so if your eyes are open, there are all kinds of marvels to be had when you're running with nature. You're looking and you're present. That's the difference.
You really make me want to go out for a run. But sadly, here I am in lockdown Spain, and we're confined to quarters. And we do, my wife and I have a nice routine now of walking around our garden, but not really the space really for a proper run. But when this thing's done, I'm going to get back into running, because that just sounds so delicious, you're talking about.
Great.
And so anything else with that, the fuel, obviously what you're putting in, what you're doing with the motor, you've talked about, what else is going on for you in Mojo?
I mean, those things are the foundations of it. So the running as well as fitness, it builds resilience. So if you can get through the circuit, particularly if it's feeling unpleasant or you're feeling tired, you can get through it and you build up practice. Some people have been running for the first time during COVID, and after a few weeks of it, they feel that it's improving their mental resilience as well, which is what people always talk about with exercise. And so you get two for one. You get physical fitness, but you also get mental fitness as well. So that's part of it. And so it's easier then for me to come back and to be able to use that mojo in the work that I do. So also, because I write books, my life is spent in isolation anyway. So the COVID-19 right. Self-isolation isn't actually very unusual for people who do what I do, because we're alone anyway. The only thing that's slightly inconvenient is we can't go out for coffee, but we are as busy as we were before, because all we do is sit at desks and write stuff. The only thing that's different is the flow of money has stopped, but yes, we're still writing, you know, so we're still busy. Yeah. There's been no change to our office, our working practice. In fact, if anything, now is maybe the best time to be a writer right now, because you can get work done in silence and solitude and without people chasing you for stuff. So this is now probably the most creative time for people like me.
Mm. And I was going to ask about creativity, and in that, obviously you're used to the, you know, writing in the confines, or in your own company in the confines of your home, that's comfortable. But are you lacking the creativity of when you do go out and see and feel things, or is the creativity still coming to you?
It's flowing now more intensely than ever for me. And I think that's a result of all of the things that I've just described. Also, the idea of restriction for me has enhanced the creativity and kind of enhanced the mojo. If you can imagine what happens if you squeeze a lot of data through a small space, it kind of increases in intensity. And that's kind of what I'm feeling by not being allowed to go out whenever I want to, by having restrictions on when I can, how I can buy food. All of this stuff is kind of channeling energy, intensifying energy through a narrower funnel. And so that is kind of having the effect of a more intense burst of creativity. So, but this is also about how I processed it mentally. I mean, obviously a lot of people aren't doing this kind of thing. They're catastrophizing, or they're talking about how horrible this thing is, or they're worrying about what they can't get in the supermarkets. But it really does depend on what attitude you have. But running helps, as I say, because it builds resilience. And so the more you exercise, the fitter you are, I think, the fitter you are mentally as well when adversity comes.
And you used the word there, I love that description of intensity, in terms of this creative intensity you're feeling. Just to move us on slightly, because we're going to talk about your book shortly, and that's all about relationships, and specifically meeting people online and your experiences with that. But just sticking with lockdown for now, what do you yourself, what you're experiencing, what are you seeing with the intensity of people's relationships as we're all, as you said, incarcerated together? Hopefully it's a great thing, but I can imagine for some people it's a bit of a challenge. What are you seeing?
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of stuff being said about couples and families that are not used to being together reacting negatively. We've had lots of conversations about increases in domestic abuse cases, etc., because people are cooped up. So that's very interesting and also quite disturbing. The idea that spending concentrated time with your loved ones, maybe something that you don't want to do or that is causing you stress, is quite curious to me, you know, in a way. Mm-hmm. But because you think, wow, that sounds lovely. I mean, the chance to be with my wife and kids in a way that I don't usually because I'm away working. But for some people, it is the away working that makes their life livable and comfortable and manageable. It's the being with the people for large amounts of time that some people seem to be struggling with. But I imagine that the people that are struggling with it the most are the ones whose relationships are kind of fracturing anyway. So if you're in a relationship working and then suddenly you have to spend a month in the same flat with that person, that may not be something that is pleasurable. But it might be that all of these things pan out for the better in the end, because if you decide that you want to be together or you don't want to be together as a result of being self-isolating, that might be good. I mean, I think there's a strong possibility that after this is over, there will be more divorces than there usually are at New Year, because people will have somehow resolved their relationships and decided to part as a result of, you know, being cooped up together and having the time, therefore, to evaluate their relationships.
Yes, yes. There was a lot of chat about COVID-19 babies, so a baby boom coming along in kind of, you know, I guess around Christmas time. But I think what you're saying there about a divorce boom, sadly, could also be the case. Yes. But I think you're right. I think the cracks are there. This is going to put a lens on those cracks.
That's right, exactly. And probably that's good, because it means that there's questions that have not been discussed amongst the people in the relationship that need to be discussed. And so you can imagine, after sitting next to somebody in your living room on the sofa for a while and there's a problem, somebody says to the other person, I think we need to talk, or there's something I need to say to you. And then suddenly everything starts to come out. And in many cases, they will resolve their differences. In other cases, they won't.
Yeah, yeah, I hear that. And we mentioned one of the books you've written most recently. So, My Terrifying, Shocking, Humiliating, Amazing Adventures in Online Dating. I mean, I love the title of that because it's so wonderfully descriptive. Can you tell me a little bit about what drew you to write this book in the first place, Ben?
I was online dating, and I was actually in the middle of another book, which I haven't finished yet, when I was online dating. And my ideas and thoughts and observations about online dating started getting in the way of the other book I was writing. It was like a download that was happening at the same time. It was interfering. And so I decided to put the other book to one side and just deal with this material that was coming out of me. And anybody who writes books knows that when the flow is there, going back even to Mojo, when the flow is there with a book, you have to do it. You have to take it when it's there, because it might not be there later. You know, you can't say, I'll come back to this in 3 years' time. So I took 5 months off from the other book and wrote this one. I came to it because I wanted to see if my story, which is that of a 50-something man discovering the crazy reality of online dating, how I might be able to communicate my experiences with other people who may be experiencing the same or similar things, because online dating for our age group has not really been covered with the same degree of energy as the other social groups. So most of the books that have been written so far about online dating would tended to come from young, white, middle-class women. And their narratives are very, very important. But there were other narratives missing. I couldn't see the narrative of the 50-something divorced, slightly cynical person with two children for whom dating is difficult. So we weren't being talked about. And I thought that there was a real opportunity here to try and say something, because our age group, I think, needs online dating more than the youngsters, because our social networks are that much smaller. You know, when you're young and full of energy or mojo, if you like, you can get up Friday night, have a shower, get an Uber to Dalston, go out dancing, whatever. Your social network is more energized. But when you're divorced and in your 40s and you're working hard and you're running a house and you've got children, you just don't have the energy for that. So when you put the kids to bed on Friday night, there's not much left for you other than to flop on the sofa with a glass of wine and Netflix. So where are we going to find partners from? So in a way, we need online dating more than the youngsters for that reason. But there's nothing that actually prepares us for how to do it or what to expect. This is what I found missing when I started.
Right. And you were sort of thrust into this scenario personally, right? This wasn't just research you were doing. You were doing this for real.
Yes. So my summary journey was I had a very painful breakup from the person that I was seeing. It was a 6.5-year relationship. She said to me one day she didn't want to see me anymore. It was very abrupt and without much of an explanation. And so that really damaged me in a very profound way, because the narrative of why was kind of missing. And so in everybody's breakup, the preamble, which is the deterioration of the relationship, is a very important part of the processing. So, you know, you go through the usual moves. You're not talking very, very often. Somebody's sleeping in a separate room. You're having rows, et cetera, et cetera. All of these things are important in the sort of slow exit. Anyway, these things were missing from mine, which meant that I just got an announcement. And that meant that I was very, very damaged as a result of it, and was walking around with a head full of anger and pain and sadness and not having the answers that I thought I needed. And so I came to online dating 10 weeks after that, and I was convinced within myself that I was ready to be online dating and looking for a new partner, because the time was right. And it's only with hindsight that I realized that I actually wasn't ready at all, but actually I was still very wounded and was using the internet dating scenario as part of my recovery mechanism. So as soon as you get people who like you, who respond to your profile, you know, you kind of feel the dopamine in your brain start to react. Wow, so I'm not a monster. I am lovable. People are responding to me. And in my research, this is one of the things that I discovered internet dating was very good for, but that it wasn't designed for. You know, people talk about it as something which is designed to get couples together, but actually it may be more effective as part of your recovery mechanism when you're coming out of a relationship.
So these people are swiping. I don't know if it's left or right on Tinder, because I've never used it, but the positive way. And you're getting that very quick feedback, I guess, as an immediate feedback loop on, yes, people like me, I have value. As you said, that dopamine hit comes. And when you're in pain, when you're grieving even a previous relationship, that's very good for you.
Yes, that's right. And I'm not criticizing it necessarily, because as a mechanism for healing, it has a use, and it might be that internet dating is better for that than it is for finding people their ultimate partners. We all need to heal, and one way to heal is to know that other people like you. You know, what's difficult is that person who is liking you wants more than just to be a kind of collateral damage in you feeling better. You know, that's when it can be difficult. And so this is one of the big difficulties in online dating, is that there are so many different categories. And so in the book, I suggest that there are actually 5 different intentions present on the dating apps at once. So most of us think there are only 2 intentions. 1, to meet up for sex, or 2, to meet up with the intention of finding a relationship, loving relationship. But in fact, there are 3 other intentions present in the apps. So there are people, for example, who are just looking at faces and nothing else. They don't want to talk. They don't want to meet. They're just looking. Mm-hmm. Perhaps they're damaged in a relationship and they're not ready to engage further. But all they're doing is looking at faces. Then there are people who are looking at faces and swiping positively. In other words, accruing attention, helping rebuild their self-esteem by gathering likes, if you like. But they're not talking and they're not meeting anybody. And then there are people who are looking at faces, talking, and messaging. In other words, they want the interaction, but they may not necessarily meet either. So, and then, of course, you've got people who do meet for sex and people who do meet for relationships. So right there, there are five different intentions that are present on the dating apps at any one time, all thrown into the same barrel. And so it's very difficult then to know which of the five categories you're communicating with when you meet somebody. And that is the key reason why the apps are so chaotic. But this is part of the business model. So chaos means that it's harder to find your match, which therefore means that you keep paying your subscription. So failure is the business model for dating apps. They don't want you to succeed, because if you succeed, then you leave. And if you leave, you don't pay any more money.
They don't want successful relationships.
No,
what's coming out of this?
What's in it for them? If you find the love of your life, what's in it for them? What they want, money. They want you to not find your love of your life so that you will keep paying. So we make the mistake of thinking that internet dating apps exist to help us find our partners. But actually, that's not their objective. Their objective is to make money for the shareholders, is their primary objective. And they can only do that by retaining the customer at all costs, which means we want you to not leave. This is why, if you look at what the dating apps are doing now, many of them now classify themselves not as dating apps, but as connecting apps or as social apps. And they're all introducing other things alongside dating, other reasons, in fact, for you to be there other than dating, because they want you to continue to pay the subscription. And then indeed the in-app purchase that you can buy when you are within the apps themselves. So for example, Tinder has a particular feature which allows you to boost your profile to the top of the rankings for 3 hours during peak time.
And really?
Yes. And that facility they have costs £39 per go. So if you want one 3 hour hit, that's £39 each time you want to do it to boost your profile to the top of the rankings, where you then get more traffic.
Right. So it's kind of like like paid Google search.
Yes, it's like a video. It's like a video game. You pay for a booster, if you like.
Right.
So this is how they make their money. They're not bleeding hearts who want you to find love. They don't mind if a few people find love, of course, because that helps drive the marketing engine. But they don't want everybody to find love. It's not in their interest. But, you know, there are many businesses predicated on the same thing. Dentistry, for example, predicated on a similar thing. They make their money from our inability to look after our teeth. If everybody looked after their teeth, there'd be no dentists. So they don't want that. They don't mind if a few people have better teeth, but they don't want you all looking after your teeth. Same with the police force. The police are happy if there's less crime, but they don't want no crime, because then they're out of a job. So there are many businesses that are predicated on this kind of thing. And internet dating is one of the ones that we don't often think about, because we think it's about everybody finding their partners.
Yeah, you sort of dress it up in it's about romance, it's about love. Some of them are about hookups, and I guess, as you say, if people are upfront about that, it's kind of okay. But as you say, there are these numerous segment groups with different intentions that are kind of going on these sites. And yes, I one part of me, I understand the commercial side of it. That's my previous world. But equally, it's pretty cynical, isn't it? And when you put it that way, that the it's not designed, it's not gamed for you to find success. But your book then is kind of like a manual, a toolkit to find success in internet dating, on online dating. Is that right?
Yes, that's a big part of it, because statistically, more relationships now happen online than off. So despite the nostalgia of the divorced oldies about how lovely it was when we met partners in the analog way, in bars and cafes and dinner parties and stuff, and how lovely that was. Yeah. There's just no point now in us behaving like Luddites and resisting the march of technology. So reality now is that most couples now meet online. It's gone beyond the 50% mark. And so history tells us whenever technology comes and seizes any culture, it takes it. And those who resist just fall off the edge. So, you know, we've seen this numerous times throughout history when silent movies move to talking films, for example, or when home entertainment went from physical VHS videos to streaming. When technology arrives for something, it takes it. And internet dating is there. And so my narrative is, whether we like it or not, this is the present and the future. And so we have to find a way to make it work for us. And so, and I say make it work for us in an environment in which the apps are not designed to work for us, because there's not much money in that. And also the apps are not designed for the diversity of social groups that are using them. So, you know, if you look at who's behind dating apps, it's the same kind of social group that are behind the rest of tech. So dating apps have mostly been designed by young white men for their own prerogatives, basically. So when you think about the experience of women or the experience of minorities, that they weren't really considered at the beginning. It was about young men getting what they wanted. And this is why the apps have not worked so well for women and ethnic minorities. And you can see that from the reaction that the dating apps have to abuses. So the policy has always been reactive as opposed to proactive. So the dating apps react to abuse complaints from users, or racism complaints from users, or sexism complaints from users. So in other words, what this tells you is that those elements that are now using the app were not catered for at the beginning. It's a kind of add-on. It's like, oh, blimey, black people and women are complaining. What are we going to do, guys? You know, they're kind of retrofitting activity onto platforms that were not designed with those people in mind. This is the same with social media generally. Twitter and Facebook have had the same problem with not devising a system which is completely inclusive and diverse. So my narrative is, okay, given all of those circumstances I've just mentioned, how can we make the apps work better for us? And so what we can do as consumers is create better profiles, write better profiles, and have better photography within those profiles so that our communication is optimized. So this is a very, very big part of it, because what I found in my experience is that most people's profiles are not optimized. You've got people who are posting suboptimal photographs, blurry images, pictures of them not smiling, or pictures of the backs of their heads or with their faces concealed, or worse, people not having any narrative at all within the written sections that the dating apps have. And so you think, okay, well, why would anybody volunteer in a democracy to silence their own voice? So here's you. Here's an opportunity to say how amazing you are as a single person and to tell the dating world that you're ready to date. And instead you choose silence. There's an empty box with no writing in it. And so this, when you look at all of these things, you realize actually the dating apps are not to blame on their own. We are also to blame for posting material which is not doing us justice. And so
Just
Yeah, if
so, just being a bit half-hearted with it, by the sounds of it.
Exactly, and the rule there must be, if anybody is posting anything on the internet of any description, which is not clear or misleading, etc., then you are part of the problem of the internet. So it's one thing for many of these people to complain about internet dating and how it's full of horrible people, etc. But if your profile is not fully optimized, then you are part of that problem too. So part of what I say in the book with the guidelines and recommendations that I offer is fix your profile, optimize. If everybody did that, there'd be many, many more matches.
What are some, just getting into some of the detail of that, you talked about the photography, you know, it seems really obvious, but I know exactly what you mean. Just from social media profile pictures of people not taking a lot of care of it, or just showing you know, yourself smiling, I guess, because that's what people want to see. It's you at your optimum self.
Yes, that's right. I mean, the research has shown that photographs in which a subject is smiling and with eyes to camera, those pictures receive 20% higher engagement than any other type of photo. And no surprise there, because human beings are wired for a smiling face where you are looking at them. And so it's not a surprise that that sort of photo gets the maximum reaction. But actually, when you look at online dating profiles, not very many people do that. And you think, well, what's happening here? So if somebody chooses a picture of themselves when they're in which they are not smiling, or indeed looking sad, or looking away from camera, what does that mean? If we are all the editors, curators within our own dating profiles, what does it mean when somebody chooses a picture of themselves in which they are looking away? It might be that that person isn't really ready for a relationship, even though they may say they are consciously. Or if somebody is showing you a picture of themselves where they're looking sad, well, maybe they are sad, because they've chosen that picture. So there's an interesting disconnect, if you like, sometimes between conscious intention and subconscious intention. You know, you may say consciously, yes, I'm ready for a relationship. I'm ready. Everything is great. I'm ready to find the man of my life, the woman of my life. But the photographs they choose say the opposite. So there's a gap between the two poles within the person's understanding of themselves. So there is a lot of, this is apparent across so many dating profiles, that it's a kind of habitual pattern. So what it made me realize was that everybody, and myself included, when I first started online dating, you have to start with the self. In other words, hang on, where am I in my recovery? Am I self-aware about where I am emotionally? And therefore, should I even be internet dating at this time? Or should I be working on myself first? If I am posting a picture of myself looking distinctly unhappy, should I be going away and working on that first, rather than showing everybody my damaged self? So these are questions that people aren't really asking that are a crucial part of it. So in the book, I'm just trying to say, well, look, these are the issues. These are the places where we need to start thinking about things, thinking about the self before we project onto others in our conclusions about there not being very many decent people online, which I hear a lot, etc. Before we go there, first question is, well, hang on, is my profile fully optimized? Am I ready? So, you know, I hear a lot of from when I speak to friends with internet dating profiles, and they say these things a lot. They say things like, oh, I didn't really put much time into it, or I just threw up the pictures really, really quickly. And I think, well, why not? Why didn't you put much time into it? Because a dating profile is essentially a resume, and possibly the most important resume of your life, if you consider that you're looking for what they call a life partner, which will outlast your job, for which you have a better resume. And so...
Yeah, of course. I better put more time into their CV or their resume than they did their internet dating profile.
That's right. So if your work resume takes you 3 days to draft and redraft, and it has no spelling mistakes in it, and it is a very, very polished document. Well, your dating resume should do the same thing. So it should also take you several hours to refine it, if that's what it needs. And you should also put the same amount of time into it, if not more, because finding love is no less important than finding the job that you seek.
It's a high stakes game, right?
Absolutely. And in a way, if you only put 5 minutes into your profile, well, why would you expect an amazing result for not much effort? The reason we do actually expect an amazing result is because we're used to finding relationships being easy. That's the problem. So everybody in their 40s and 50s who's single now remembers a time when finding a boyfriend or girlfriend was quite straightforward in terms of how social interactions happen. You don't have to put much work into it. It just seemed to happen. Online dating is the reverse of that. It's work. So you have to find great pictures. You have to write a really succinct bio. And if you follow the guidelines in my book, you have to consistently review your profile and change it. So what I say is a dating profile should never be a static document. I know people whose dating profiles have not changed for years. And I think, man, why not? So if it's not worked, if you've not found the person you're looking for, why would you not change it? This is a straightforward marketing conversation. It's like, look,
I was going to say, what brand would leave its story unadapted, unoptimized, if no one was buying the brand?
Right. So it's not working. Let's change the pictures, or let's change the copy and try it again. Let's run tests. So what I propose is change the photography after 2 weeks and see if that attracts a different type of person, or change what you've written and see if that attracts a different kind of person. A dating profile should never be a static document. You should always be working it and changing it and seeing if you can get a different result. But people don't do it. They just think, this is what I've done and I'm not going to do anything else. And then they complain when it doesn't work. And so what I'm saying is we need to all do more work if we want to get the best out of the platform. Because I'm convinced that amazing people are on there. I'm totally convinced by that. It's just we need to put ourselves in the best position to be able to receive or be contacted by those people. It's almost like, you know, finding your partner is a needle in a haystack. But if you've got a metal detector, it's easy to find a needle.
Yes. Another wonderful metaphor. And I'm minded that, you know, kind of going back to the beginning of our conversation about where we are right now in lockdown, so many people, well, everyone's working from home. And you talked about how, you know, lots of us meet partners. I'm like probably many people. I met my wife at work. And that's a story for an awful lot of people. And I'm envisaging a near future where that kind of shifts and changes. So online dating is going to become even more important. And as you say, the work that goes into it, the time, the effort, the passion that goes into your profiles can become even more important. Do you think that's the case?
Yes. I mean, look, we have 5 million self-employed people in this country, in the UK, sorry. And that number will increase after COVID-19, because some people who've established home working will not go back. These are the kinds of things that happen when crises like this take place. And so we are looking at a future in which there are even fewer people in offices meeting colleagues romantically. So then how does the home worker find a relationship when they're working from home? Who are they meeting? They have no social network. So, for example, I'm a writer. I don't have a social network. You don't have a group that you meet after work. So how do those people, and it's a growing group, not just driven by COVID-19, but driven also by employers who are downsizing expensive real estate offices and stuff, who want smaller footprints, who realize that people have got kids, and in the post-Me Too revised situation, they need to provide more flexible working conditions, particularly for mums who are fantastic employees. And so therefore facilitating the home working environment is increasing exponentially. So where are those people going to find their partners? Internet dating is the only outlet for them. And so, again, we need it, and we just need to work it better.
Got it. And all these fantastic tips in your book, and I know on your LinkedIn and your Instagram account are super helpful for people, and I'll put links to those in the show notes. And Ben, I'm just mindful. Obviously, you wrote the book and you were dating, and how has that gone for you?
Very good. I'm glad you're asking that, because people really are on me about that. They say, "Okay, Mr. Dating Guru guy, you all these guys, you meet anybody?" And they're kind of looking at me to say, "Okay, here we go." And actually, I'm happy to report that I have. So, but let me just say, it was only after I took a different approach to my dating profile and started implementing the ideas I put in the book around trying different photography and tweaking the bio and all of these things, putting work into it, if you like, that it started to change. And also, alongside that, my ability to better identify people who were ready for a relationship. So going back to what I was saying about what it means if somebody is showing you photographs of themselves in which they look unhappy or hiding their faces, being able to interpret the warning signs, if you like, meant that I was able to sort of make better choices. And so in the end, I met somebody on one of the big UK dating apps. And it was one of those ones in which there is a very, very large facility to tell your story. I think they have 3,000 characters in their profile with which you can say who you are and what your situation is. So straight away, that attracts a certain kind of person who's ready to write and fill all of that in and be open.
Yeah.
And so what that means in reality is that so much is revealed, you can assess and get to the date much faster because so much data is there. And this is a very important point. So on a lot of the swipe-based apps, particularly where people don't write anything or write very little, what it then means is when your interaction starts, you've got to ask a lot of questions before you can get to the stage where you decide whether you're meeting or not. So there's a lot of to-ing and fro-ing of texts and stuff, which is tiring. So if you can imagine, if you've got to do that every single time you connect with somebody, you start to run out of gas. Whereas if the profile, if you reveal a lot of information in this particular dating app, then you can get to meeting quite quickly. So with this particular woman I'm seeing now, we exchanged maybe two messages and then we went straight to meeting for a drink because so much data was revealed at the beginning in the profile. So anyway, so we met up and there was a really interesting energetic thing with us because we looked at each other and there was a weird feeling that we'd met before in this life or the last one or something. So we looked at each other and kind of frowned like, hey. So there was some kind of calm, comfortable familiarity there with us straight away. After a couple of dates, then off we went. And I was able to delete the apps, which is an amazing moment. But I don't think it's a one-off thing where you know, it just happened to me and I got lucky. I think, you know, it can happen to all of us if we are really paying attention to how the apps work, the motivations of the people that have created them, and how we can nevertheless use them better to find somebody that we are looking for.
Yeah, brilliant. And well, firstly, great to hear that, you know, following your own advice has proved immensely fruitful for you. Really, really pleased to hear that, Ben. And thank you for those tips so people can, you know, now they could obviously, I think there's quite a lot of online dating going on right now, probably not a lot of meeting, but a lot of, you know, at least checking out going on. And when this thing is passed, I'm really hopeful that people can apply those tips that you've shared and that are in the book and get so much more out of it and find love, because that's what the world needs more of.
Absolutely.
Ben, that has just been a wonderful conversation. I'm going to put links to various articles you've written.
Right.
I know a place where you do a lot of your writing now, link to the book and your social links all in the show notes, so people can come and check you out. Not for dating, obviously, because that's done, but for all other things. Right. So, Ben, thank you so much for your time. Been great having you on the Mojo podcast.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you very much.
What a great chat, and what a voice Ben has, both his tone, but more so what he has to say. I love talking to him. I really don't think it matters whether you're actively dating or not. This chat had so much in it to take away. There's a pure joy of running in nature that he talked about, how we can benefit from that intensification of creative energy right now. And on the dating front, like so much in life, to get the result you want, you really must put the effort in. There is a quote I like from positive psychology guru Anthony Duckworth about where real achievement in life comes from. And he talks about how real achievement is talent plus effort, and that gets you skills. And skills plus effort, well, that gets you real achievement. And the key here is that effort counts twice as much as everything else. And I think that works both in dating and with so much in life. I hope you enjoyed the episode. Please do subscribe, leave a 5-star rating, and to boost my own profile, please do write a short review on Apple Podcasts. All of these things really do matter and help the Mojo podcast become more discoverable to more people. Please do stay safe, stay home, follow good advice, and I really, really hope that in these uncertain times that your mojo continues to flow.